pleasure to be back at the Boise or Boise?
Boise.
Boise Center. This isn't being, oh, it already is being recorded. I've already
cut that part off, don't worry.
Perfect, yes. Okay, anyway, it's wonderful to see all of you here, some who I have known and spoken to before, some who I look forward to speaking to more in the future. And what I thought I would do today is just follow the rules and to take no more than 15 or possibly 20 minutes. Talk about who I am, what brought me to this work, and what I'm working on and what issues we're thinking about. Okay. Who I am, I'm somebody who has been cursed by the name gods. I'm not a man, you know, before people could easily see. Now that's been solved by the internet because people look up and so they see that I'm not a man. But the surprise trick of Ellis Island, that came out many years later, no, we're not related. We were just both given the same name. We don't even have the same original name. And we thought it was maybe fading, but then I got a text from my sister, beware the miniseries. And my other sister, who has been quite discouraging about this from the start, said that's what the Ponzi's thought about the future of their name, but in any event, not related. So I want to, pick up where I last left off when last here at the Boise Center, and I can't remember whether it was 3 or 4 years ago or when I was talking about my book, which I brought because it has an excellent cover, which is on immortality and the law, the rising power of the American dead. I had nothing to do with this cover, but I was quite pleased with it, a fistful of dollars. And what it was about is about how the law treats interests of the dead and when do we let the dead live on after death because we continue to respect their wishes, and when do we say, who cares, you're dead, you're gone, you're off stage now. And this book examined it in all different contexts. And one of the contexts in which I examined it was about the charitable sector, people committing money for charitable purpose. Because if you think about it, that is one of the ways that people can most easily preserve their perpetuity and preserve their perpetual life. I don't have time to talk about it now, but in the book, one of the things I found in my research is the great story about Alfred Nobel and how there'd been a obituary written about him before he died. They thought he had died, and it said horrible things about him. And so after that, he created the Nobel Foundation. Now we think Nobel, and we have wonderful. I can tell you afterwards. I'm not going to use my time on that. But anyway, so people, and if you think about it, names like Carnegie and Ford and Rockefeller, those names are very much familiar to us, not because of the original people, but because of the fact that they have been immortalized through their private foundations. Okay. And so that was the lens through which I got involved in this. I wrote one of the things that this book brought me to, too, was the world of op-eds. I started my very first op-ed that I wrote in the Times was about this issue, about the Leona Helmsley charitable trust, and how she was able to be immortalized as a great person through her charitable trust, which you might remember was, this is great to know, she originally set it up for the benefit of dogs and the indigent. But then she was sitting around looking at it, you know, thinking about what she really wanted, and she decided to cross out the last part. So, anyway, I was interested, people were always talking about what a great person Leona Helmsley was, not that she was a good person in her life, but at least she created this charitable trust. And so she gave to charity, and isn't giving to charity good? And I began to think about, well, what does it mean for somebody to give to charity? What does it mean for somebody to create one of these institutions named after themselves? And what is society getting for it? Okay, so that was the question that brought me in. And I'm going to, rather than answer it now, I want to step back and just talk a little bit about some of the historical ways that we have come to think about these things. First of all, one of the interesting things I found is that we tend to think of these perpetual private charitable foundations as something that have existed forever. And, you know, people are always saying, oh, ever since, you know, then they find some very old time. We've always had these things. But in fact, they have quite a contested history in the United States, because when the country was formed and we were rejecting all things English, one of the early things that was rejected were these perpetual charitable trusts, right? Because the concern was that these might be somehow anti-democratic and really a problem for society. And throughout much of the 19th century, you have a rejection and throwing out of these trusts as being against public policy. And it wasn't until the early 20th century when we had confluence of two things. One was this growing wealth of the super wealthy, right? So we had the first super wealthy people coming into this country. And then you also had the growing problems of the cities. And, you know, lots of immigrants coming in, and you could see that we had all these social needs and we had all this private money. And the question was, well, maybe we should start letting this private money be applied to our social needs. Ooh, want a napkin?
Nope.
Okay. So what I want to talk about, and then what happened is when we started to, in the early part of the 20th century, allow individuals to create these private perpetual charitable entities for things they thought good. And then the other thing that happened in the early part of the 20th century was the creation of the tax system, right? So prior to the 20th century, we didn't have big federal taxes. But beginning in the 1913 and then 1915, we had the let me take a different color here. We had an income tax, and then in 1915, we had an estate tax. And an important thing happened with the enactment of those taxes, which is that for both the income tax and the estate tax, they included in them charitable deductions. Okay. They included within them charitable deductions, and the effect of this was to lay the groundwork for the development of the society that we have now. So I want to do a little bit of a comparison here between the United States and maybe we'll talk about like Western European countries, but there could be any number of countries that we're talking about, okay? And think about how we finance things like education, healthcare, it's not really working that well, but I'm just gonna, the arts, so just as well because you can't see how bad my handwriting is, social services. Okay, so let's talk about, those are some of the big categories. Education, healthcare, art, social service. Okay, think of Western European countries. How are those things financed?
Government.
Government, right? Where does the government get its money?
Tax.
Taxes, right? Money comes in from the taxes, in the form of taxes, and the government spends them directly on education, healthcare, art, social services, okay? All right, what about here in the United States? How do we do that in the United States? Are these things all funded entirely by the government?
No.
No. 1,000 points of light, right? That was the George Bush Sr. Phrase. The idea is that rather than, so one way you can do it is you can fund directly by the government, And the other way you can do it is you can fund it indirectly through what we call a public-private partnership. Okay, so if you think about, so it's not that no money comes from the government, right? The government spends some money on these things. We have some direct spending by the government on education, healthcare, arts, basic social services. Some of that comes directly. But much of it comes from this public-private partnership. Individual donors contributing wealth, something about like $300 billion each year, right, goes into the charitable sector. Then you'll start seeing all the stories. Americans are the most charitable people in the world, right? Because we fund these things indirectly as opposed to other countries that fund them directly. So that's just one thing. When you think about the thing about Americans, all that sort of self-congratulatory stuff, you'll often then see other writings that say, well, yes, but you have to also look at how much taxes people are paying, because these things, if you live in a society that funds these things through taxes, then there's not as much of a need for the money to be funding it through non-taxes, through private donations, okay? All right, so I want to talk a little bit about what it means to fund things indirectly. So let's say that somebody gives, starts their own tech something. Right, and what's good about a tech something is that a lot of the creation of things that are worth a lot of money are often done with very little investment of cost. Right, it's somebody at their computer working away. Someone was just telling me about a friend of hers, and her husband was always on the computer working away, but it turns out he was inventing Quicken. So anyway, it doesn't take much investment of capital, but you can get a lot of value from it. So let's say somebody has created something, it's worth a whole lot of money, and they're about to sell it, they're about to make a load of money, and they say, well, I think while I'm doing this, I'll take $10 million, and I will give it to some form of a charitable entity. Okay, I'm going to give it to charity. Okay. To what extent is this their private money, and to what extent is there a public investment in that money? That's the question to ask, right? So, in order to know what the public investment is, you need to know, what are the tax benefits that they're getting, right? Okay, so I'm going to quickly go through them because I'm a tax, my background is tax, and so I love this stuff, but most of you might not love it quite as much. Okay, so here are some of the tax benefits. One is that you get to offset your income tax, right, with a charitable deduction, and the effect of that offsetting your income tax is to save taxes up to the highest tax rate, which is, anybody happen to know, 39.6%. Do you mind if I call it 40%?
No.
Okay. So we have an income tax. So if you go see your tax lawyer, right, and you say, hey, I'm about to make a load of money. I want to give some to charity. I'm going to give $10 million. You know, what's this going to save me? They'll say, well, this is great. The first thing it's going to do is you are going to get to offset your other charitable income by taking a $10 million deduction, and the effect of that will be to reduce your tax liability by $4 million, right? 40%, which will save $4 million. Everyone understand that if you get to take a $10 million deduction and you would otherwise be taxed at 40%, it saves you $4 million?
Why do you have a $10 million deduction?
Because this person is giving $10 million to a charitable entity. Okay. So that gets a charitable deduction.
Okay.
Thank you for asking that, okay? So you give $10 million. The first thing you do is you get a $4 million charitable deduction. The other thing that you do is that this is now, as opposed to if you were to keep it, sell it, pay taxes, okay? So one person doesn't make a charitable investment and one person does, or, right? The other savings that you get is you get savings on capital gains. Because this, if the person had instead kept the property, they would have had to have paid 20%, $2 million in capital gains, okay? So they get a 20% savings of capital gains. That's $2 million. Also, if they had kept the property, not given it to charity, they would have had $10 million minus $4 million minus $2 million, so that's $4 million left, which would have been subject to estate taxes, that remaining $4 million at 40%. So you don't have estate taxes on this gift. That's another 40% of $4 million, and that is $1.6 million. Okay. If you add up all of these tax savings by the charitable gift, our donor has saved $7.6 million. Okay, in taxes. So another way of seeing this is that when somebody makes a $10 million gift, it is a gift, an after-tax gift from them of $2.4 million, right? That's how much they are worse off. And a gift from the rest of us of $7.6 million, because that's what society loses out in taxes when somebody makes this gift. Okay. All right, a couple of things here, some caveats. One, any individual might not get, depending on the size of their gift, might not get this many tax advantages, right? If somebody gives $1 billion, they might not have enough in order to take advantage of all of the tax deductions. So I'm not saying every charitable donor gets this amount, but what I'm saying is our system is set up to give this amount of benefits, and many donors get this amount of benefits. Okay? Okay, so some interesting things. I'm already overusing my time, but I'll just keep going for another few more minutes. Okay, some interesting things to note about this public-private partnership. One of them is that in this type of system, right, who decides how the money is going to be spent? Who allocates it?
Experts.
What, experts from where?
Working for the state.
Yeah, the state decides how it's going to be allocated, right? And that has both pros and cons, right? It has all the negatives of the state, but it also has the positives of the state. It has that sort of more democratic or whatever, but it's also more state-driven with all of the potential problems of the state. Here in the United States, who decides that the government is going to spend $7.6 million? On this particular $10 million gift?
The donor.
The donor. The donor is making the decision of allocating government resources. Okay. And wealthier donors get a bigger tax benefit and therefore allocate more societal revenues under this system. And where this becomes problematic is when you look at the choices of the wealthy as opposed to the choices of the less wealthy, because they tend to be to things like private foundations, which we're going to talk about, and educational institutions, which we all are in favor of, but actually the vast majority of the donations go to 35 elite universities and prep schools. Most money goes, so really a lot of our support, governmental support, goes to Harvard and Andover and Chode and all those schools. So it's a funny allocation. Okay. All right, I want to talk now about the issues that I am most interested that flow from this, just for one more minute, okay? Which is, so the charitable deduction has these pros and cons. Our charitable funding system has these pros and cons of 1,000 points of light, lots of individual support, and the growth of civil society, and, you know, all sorts of good things about it. So I don't want to be seen as being like, oh, I'm for the government against nonprofits, but I just think that there are issues that you have to be mindful of. Okay. So there's pros and cons of this way. But what I'm interested in is another aspect of the problem, which is that when people think about the charitable sector, and when Congress talks about the charitable sector, they tend to talk about it in terms of food banks, fresh air camps, college scholarships, all this type of stuff that we think of, museums, arts, opera, all that, you know, things that we think of with the social sector. But in fact, large amounts of money does not go to organizations that are doing things, the Red Cross, stuff like that. But instead, they go to organizations that are holding the money to be spent at some time in the future. Okay? And huge amounts of money are going there. And I want to talk a little bit about, this is where my work has been, where I've been most interested, which is the areas of private foundations, and donor advised funds. Okay. Don't worry. How many of you have heard of private foundations? How many of you have heard of donor advised funds? How many of you have not heard of donor advised funds? Yeah, okay, good. So, private foundations. Private foundations are, like we talked about, Rockefeller, Ford, Hewlett, Carnegie, Bronfman, a whole bunch of them. What do we ask of our private foundations? Now we get back to my Leona Helmsley. So we know there has been a significant public investment in the creation of somebody's private foundation, right? Because they've saved all of these taxes. Well, what do they need to do with their private foundation, right? Because now this is money that is controlled by the very donors who have set it up, right? They've taken the money, they've moved it into this thing called the private foundation. What do they need to do? What is their requirements?
Spend it.
They have to spend it. How much do they have to spend?
20% a year?
5% a year.
Oh, dear Lord.
And they have to spend 5% a year, but the 5% includes salaries and administrative expenses. Okay? So somebody can set one of these things up. They can employ their children, right? So $10 million, they have to spend $500,000 a year, right? They can employ their kids working for the foundation. They can take family trips to Belize to decide whether they want to spend there. And all of that counts for their 5%. Yes?
Does the 5% come from the principal initial donation?
No, whatever its current value is.
So including all capitalized interest?
Well, yeah, whatever it's worth at the year end, they have to spend 5%.
Okay.
So they have to spend 5%. They can spend it on salaries and administrative expenses. In 2003, there was a bill that was just about to be passed that said, no, they have to spend 5% on actual charitable expenditures. And it was subject to a last-minute lobbying, actually, by independent sector, which is the charitable arm of, the supposedly the organization that represents charities. And they said, no, because then we might not be able to exist in perpetuity. The most important thing is that we exist in perpetuity. And this is what I call the high moment of perpetuity even before charity, perpetuity of overall. So anyway, that bill did not pass, although you still see people grumbling about this. Okay. So that's private foundations. Donor advised funds are actually the fastest growing form of charitable giving. They are run by, in two different places, one, the second largest charity in terms of donations this year. Number one was the United Way. Anyone want to guess what number two was?
Zuckerman.
What's that? This was that who receives donations? Donations from the public.
Red Cross.
You'd think the Red Cross, but not. Anyone have guesses?
Harvard.
Harvard would be another good guess. Fidelity Charitable. Number two was Fidelity Charitable. Number four was Vanguard Charitable. Number six was Schwab Charitable. Basically, the financial industry has gotten into the business of creating charities. The charities are designed to hold charitable dollars. They are public charities designed to hold charitable dollars. Guess how much they have to spend each year? Nothing. They don't have any payout requirement at all. Now, the money, they're better than private foundations because the money can't go to salaries and administrative expenses, but there is no time frame. By the way, what do you think Fidelity, Schwab, and Vanguard do with this money?
Invest it.
Invest it and make fees, right? And so they really have no interest in encouraging it. The other big runners of donor advised funds are all of the community foundations, Silicon Valley Community Foundation, Boston Foundation. All of the community foundations have now gotten into the business of holding donor advised funds. What do you think they get from them? One thing they get is access to donors, right? They know who has money, so that's a good thing. But the other thing that they also get are administrative fees. And many of the community foundations are running donor advised funds and using the management fees to support them. And so they get a lot of money from keeping money under management. And basically what's happened in the charitable world is there has been a huge increase in money under management as opposed to money actually being spent for charitable purpose. And that is what has been motivating a lot of my current work in this area. It's because I can't stand the fact that when Congress and others talk about charitable sector, they think they're talking about food banks, but really what they're talking about are big bank accounts of money subject to money managers who are benefiting from having money under management. And there's been a huge shift in that direction. And so what I have done, and let me just take one more minute to talk about that and then open it up to questions, is we began by creating, we had a meeting, I brought some things, called the Convention on Promoting Meaningful Reform in Philanthropy. And we did this about a year and a half ago and brought together leading people in philanthropy along with a bunch of academics who had actually written but to say, hey, our philanthropic world, maybe we don't have the best rules here. And we had a two-day, day and a half meeting at BC at the law school to talk about, like, well, what do people think? Do people think these are issues? And we got a lot of, yes, these are real issues. So that was a little validating thing. And based on that, we went on to create this thing called the Boston College Law School Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good that was designed to address some of these things. So we just began this year. The first thing that we did is, oh, two quick things. One, for those interested in starting things, we were actually able to get all these organizations to fund us, who normally would hate us, for Hewlett, Carnegie, Barr, Kalman Foundation, Chicago Community Trust, a whole bunch of organizations. And we did it by, I'm happy to talk to people about how one starts these things. We started with small donations, then we did a few more, and then we let people know we had other. You can get small donations, and then once you have their names, you can really leverage it. So that's what we did. Anyway, and so then the work that we've done this year is the first thing that we did was we had a conference in Washington, D.C. called The Rise of Donor Advised Funds, Should Congress Respond? We got all these academics to write papers on it. We distributed the papers on the Hill. We had a debate. We had all sorts of stuff. It was like, it was filled with people that run donor advised funds, community foundations, and Fidelity Schwab and Vanguard, all those people. It was like throwing a wedding or a big party where everybody hates you. It was kind of interesting. Anyway, then we had a philanthropy boot camp for journalists because of the feeling that the public doesn't, a lot of this stuff is not really being expressed. So we had all these journalists come and we had a great program that gave them, you know, basic resources and access to information about journalists. We had great journalists who came from the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and we had an invitational group, and you're welcome to see this, 60 Minutes, New York Times, Chronicle, Philanthropy, ProPublica, Bloomberg, all of that. And then we're having a conference at Stanford with the Stanford Philanthropy and Civil Society Program that basically questions this, the perpetuities model. Should the perpetuities model be the one that we always reach for in philanthropy, or does it impose some cost? So that's the program we're doing in the spring.